Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her mouth.
Some say we're all connected. Some say we're all alone. I say it's because we're alone that we seek connections. When you find that connection, or better yet, when you realize that the myriad connections that run everywhere are out there everywhere, that's when we find transcendence. It's a spiritual thing to want to connect. Last year at this time, we studied the theme of connections on Yin Radio and found four stories on the topic. Today, we're going to bring those stories back again. An encore presentation with live hosting. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and our theme is, as it was in last January, connections. Installment number one, lesbian pulp fiction. It's a genre of books that you don't hear about very often. Now let's start with pulp fiction. That's paperback fiction that's churned out really quick and cheap to make money. And the stories were always for non-mainstream audiences. Just regular folks, it's not high literature. Now, we might think mainly of cheap romance novels being the theme of pulp fiction publishers today. But pulp fiction got its start in the late 1800s, when tales of science fiction and fantasy were published in the pulp paper magazines of the day. Later, man's struggles with dark, powerful forces entered the pulp fiction scene. And by the 1950s, pulp fiction markets took on other forces, including lesbianism. Demaree Woolway is an English major. For her master's degree, she studied lesbian pulp fiction and its impact on society. She found that the genre was instrumental in forming a lesbian community. Here's Demaree Woolway, Lesbian Pulp Fiction.
Strange Sisters, World Without Men, Queer Patterns. What could these cheap novels possibly have to do with the formation of a lesbian identity? Quite a lot, in fact. I'd like to show you how this was possible, first by covering the history of these pulps in all of their trashy glory. And then I would like to give you my interpretation of why these pulps were important and how they served a community-building function for the nascent lesbian community. I will argue that for some women, being a lesbian was actually defined by these books and the communities in which they were in which they participated and the ways in which these books were interpreted. To begin with, the history of pulps. In the United States, paperback novels began appearing in 1939 as inexpensive reprints of hardback novels. So as is the case now, literary works were released in hardcover initially, and then after the hardcover market was exhausted, the more inexpensive softcover books appeared as a means of reaching a new population, potentially one without as much money to invest in softcover books. By 1950, you had publishers releasing paperback originals. So these were books that never were published in hardcover. They went straight to softcover, maybe the version of a straight-to-DVD video these days. So they were cheaply written, cheaply produced novels that actually could make quite a bit of profit that way. The publishers relied on, as you can see, the vividly painted covers and the tempting taglines to make a sale. So this is when you start to see noir, detective novels, Western novels, and they start to go into sexual topics on that way. Often they're dealing with topics that are sort of on the margins of the law. So you have Mickey Spillane's Detectives and Dames. You have Westerns that deal with men taking the law into their own hands. And then you also have sexuality that is sort of on the margins as well. And so you have, I put up this one here, which deals with interracial sex, and you see the tagline, "She was white, he was not." And this is actually a distinct subgenre that almost always deals with a white woman and a black man. And you could, I've not read any of these, so I don't know much about them and couldn't write a whole story about them. But judging from the covers, you can tell that there was a lot of them and that that was something that people were interested in exploring somehow. They were available in unconventional locations, like drugstores and train stations, showing that they were even physically detached from a critical literary sphere. They were not being sold in bookstores and things like that. So instead of being seen as literary works, they were seen as commodity objects. A 1960 article by Robert Alden explains that, quote, "If an editor feels there is a demand for doctor, nurse, hospital books or teenage romance books, he can find an author and have a book written to fill the demand." Moreover, because these books were written outside of the conventional literary sphere, they were free to examine topics considered taboo, especially sexuality. Even in the liminal space of drugstores and train stations, the sexual nature of many of these books prompted concern among many people. In a 1965 article in the New York Times, Paul Montgomery rails against what he calls pulp sex novels. I want to specify that those, some of these books were slightly spicy. For the most part, they were not pornographic. They would sort of deal in euphemism more than any like specific description of sexual acts, for example. Montgomery expresses outrage at the open trade of, quote, "lurid titles exploring lesbianism, nymphomania, male homosexuality, sadomasochism, fetishism, incest, and other pursuits that used to be treated primarily in medical journals." Montgomery also quotes a publisher reflecting that, quote, "lesbianism is the most popular theme at present because the reader gets two immoral women for the price of one." There are two important elements of Montgomery's article that I'd like to emphasize here. First, that the sexual nature of the books was primarily a profit-making venture. So he even refers to lesbianism as being somehow thrifty when you get two for the price of one. Second, the presumed reader for these books is always male. And for that matter, he's not a very desirable kind of a male. Montgomery quotes a anonymous male pulp writer who says that, quote, "men buy such books to feel superior to the heroines, who were either sexually insatiable, inclined towards lesbianism, or aggressively given to other unattractive practices." With this article, you can clearly see how these books were understood in polite society. And admittedly, some of these books do seem to merit Montgomery's kind of outrage. For example, Crack Up by March Hastings shows a sexually frustrated woman who deals with her husband's impotence by moving between numerous sexual partners, with her husband's rival, their race car drivers, oddly enough, with the lesbian down the street, even with a homeless man in the park. Or Women Without Men by Reed Marr, one of many books that shows women's prisons as a hotbed of lesbian depravity. Or Spring Fire by Vin Packer, which follows a rather touching relationship between two women, only to have one of the women go crazy and be institutionalized while the other decides she's straight and finds a boyfriend. One of the things you can also see in these books is, as Montgomery's article points out, that the target audience was generally men, and the idea is what we can think of today as the stereotypical male fantasy of two women that is somehow sexually interesting because it's not threatening. That's what you see a lot of, you can see that in a lot of these books. But one of the interesting things we do know about the constraints on publication is that authors were pretty much required to put unhappy endings for the lesbian couples in their books. So unless the novel showed lesbians somehow being punished for their immoral actions, a book might be seen as promoting lesbianism, which would therefore make it obscene. If you give them an unhappy ending or show them being punished, then it's a morality tale, and then it's okay. But these are the kind of books that made a name for the pulp genre. Melodramatic prose, titillating situations, and rather illogical sexual exploits. But If all these books were so laughably misguided, why am I presenting on them today? The truth is, not all of these books were quite the same. And in fact, if you looked closely and had a few friends to lend you their used books, it was possible to find some affirming voices in a time when there was very little information about lesbianism available. Consider, for example, some of the books of Valerie Taylor. They were published in the same format as the other books I mentioned, often with similarly inflammatory taglines. Many of these books nevertheless presented lesbians who were fully formed characters and who had desires to find love and presented with realistic challenges. So, for example, one of her novels, The Girls in 3B, it shows the lives of three women who moved to New York City together. Each of them manages to find relationships, but the most balanced and most positive of all three of the relationships is a lesbian relationship that develops between one of the girls named Barbie and a woman named Eileen Gordon. So Anise, she falls in love with an artist who is too busy getting high to care that Anise is pregnant with his child, and so Anise winds up marrying some other guy who will raise her child. Pat spends most of the book in love with a man who is engaged, and then eventually she settles down with a guy who promises the same sort of suburban mediocrity that she had moved to New York City to escape. And then you have Barbie. In contrast with these relationships, Barbie and Eileen meet each other as equals. Both have fulfilling jobs, and both care for each other. Their relationship is shown as uncompromisingly happy. Other authors, including Ann Bannon and Ann Aldrich, published pulps that showed lesbians involved in complex, caring relationships, offering some kind of representation when there was little available. Of course, if you didn't know where to look, it would be hard to distinguish the more affirming titles from those which ended in a suicide or a heterosexual marriage. And here's where I see the real community-building aspects of these novels coming in. In 1955, the Daughters of Bilitis were founded. The Daughters of Bilitis were a San Francisco-based homophile group that addressed specifically the concerns of gay women. John DeMilio's history of pre-Stonewall gay and lesbian rights movement, sexual politics, sexual communities, portrays the DOB leadership as a small, often fragmented group that nevertheless had a large impact on their membership. He describes the libraries, study groups, and speakers that the DOB sponsored. All of this indicates that the DOB sought to establish a critical sphere where various understandings of sexual identity could be examined. Literature was also clearly important to the DOB. Their newsletter, The Ladder, published a regular column called Lesbiana. This column, which was usually written by Barbara Grier under the pseudonym Jean Damon, offered capsule reviews of contemporary and older fiction. Nowadays, many apologists for lesbian pulp have argued that there weren't any options, and so lesbians had to just sort of take what was given to them, and they sort of read it uncritically, and, you know, they didn't have much choice. But the evidence in The Ladder shows the exact opposite. The response from the lesbian community published in The Ladder shows that they were highly critical of the books and well aware of their shortcomings. They read the books to find positive representations and quite stringently criticize any negative representations. So far from being grateful just for any old representation, The Ladder reviews indicate that the content of the novels mattered deeply to these lesbian readers. Through this type of reading, the pulp medium and the cultural circumstances of lesbian identity were able to come together. In fact, I believe it was by reading these representations and responding critically to them that the lesbian identity of these readers were formed. Women who read these books were constantly checking to see if their experiences aligned with these books and where the books fell short of their own experiences. Through this interaction, and through their interactions with The Ladder, women began to articulate their own lesbian identities in a way that was not possible before the books were around. Thus, for many of these women, being a lesbian meant reading books and interacting with the lesbian community. Many people wrote letters to The Ladder about pulps, engaging in literary criticism as a means of accessing the community. Some of the books saw them as useful, others criticized them as, quote, noisy, nasty titles. According to all of these letters, though, the mere representation of lesbians is not enough. The quality of the lesbian content really matters. These letters indicate that readers feel authorized to be critical interpreters of books. A reader named A.B. from California wrote, quote, I have a fair enough mind to reserve opinions of anything and everyone, so the author's criticism didn't make too much impression. These discussions within The Ladder brought readers together through the interpretation of novels. The evidence recorded in the latter demonstrates that the readers exhibited critical literary skills that made it possible to comprehend lesbian identity as an interpretive project. Readers examine literature closely and form lesbian identities through this act of interpretation. For these women, their identity as lesbians can be then defined as a membership in an interpretive community. In my understanding of the interpretive community, I'm guided by the work of Stanley Fish. Fish insists emphatically that there is nothing inherent in a text that leads to its critical interpretation. Instead, frameworks for understanding literature already exist in critical texts, in culture, and in language, and they permeate and shape the process of reading. A reader is then, quote, a member of a community whose assumptions about literature determine the kind of attention she pays, and thus the kind of literature she makes. These pulps represent a meta-literary attempt to form an alternate interpretive framework, one that allows readers to critically assess literature as it applies to identity. Along these lines, the DOB also held public discussions of novels, displaying critical skills at the same time they used the novels to bring the community together. One debate between Helen Sanders and Del Martin, one of the founding members of the DOB, examined Anne Aldrich's We Walk Alone. Their assessment of the novels demonstrates their skill at critically reading. By the conclusion of the debate, the participants indicate a willingness to take what can be learned from Aldrich's text while maintaining a critical distance from its messages. Quote, it was generally agreed that Miss Aldrich tried, that hers is a valid contribution to lesbian literature, of which there is so little, if not taken too seriously or considered gospel by those of limited experience. The debaters agree that this type of novel is only dangerous if it is read uncritically. Their solution to this problem is not to restrict reading altogether. Instead, they offer a model for preparing readers for this type of text. The DOB promote engaging critically with literature. They suggest reading We Walk Alone and other lesbian novels while being aware of their limits. This engagement with literature opens a space to critically examine the construction of lesbian identity. From these comments, it appears clear that one interpretive strategy involves reading faithfully while rejecting other parts of the literature. It seems that readers were well aware of the publishing constraint that I mentioned earlier that required an unhappy ending for the protagonists. Reviews often enjoin the readers to ignore the endings and read for the better parts of the book. In this way, lesbian identity is a product of engaging fully with texts while still contradicting parts of them. Yet this literary formation of identity did not end with the Stonewall Riots in 1969. Although the age of lesbian pulp novels ended a few years before, the books themselves lived on. Interestingly enough, the post-Stonewall era actually saw a rise in gay male pulp novels. Through the works of several feminist publishing houses, the work of maintaining the more positive pulp novels has continued. Most prominent among these is Naiad Press, which was founded by Barbara Grier, who wrote some of the literature reviews for the latter. From 1975 to 2005, Naiad Press devoted itself to publishing lesbian and women-focused novels. It also preserved many of the pulps, part of what Grier called the golden age of lesbian pulp. And I've actually brought some of the different pulps from different times that they've been reprinted, and so you're welcome to look at those, and I can pass those around because they're fun to see. And interesting also to see the shifting in the covers when they've been reprinted during different times, what people choose to focus on. And more recently, the feminist press of the City University of New York has begun reprinting certain novels. The reprinting of these books demonstrates the significance of literature to lesbian history, and the selectivity with which it's been done underscores the critical project of so many readers. In closing, these books are significant both for their history and identity and community formations for so many women, but also in their significance to modern readers. To read these pulps now, both the positive and the negative representations, is to understand how lesbian identity was negotiated from a number of different sources, and to see how the early homophile groups built these messages into a coherent movement. By reading these books now, we're able to participate in the interpretive community that argued, debated, and contested lesbian identity.
Demaree Woolway wrote her master's thesis on lesbian pulp fiction. Demaree is now at Washington State University, where she's the assistant director of the Gender Identity, Expression, and Sexual Resource Center. She allowed Yin Radio to record this presentation of her thesis work in November 2007 at the University of Idaho. Now we have installment number two. It's from Judy Parrish. Rocks have called to Judy, to Judith Totman Parrish, for years. She is the president of the Geological Society of America, and she's a University of Idaho professor of geological sciences. Now, prior to joining the University of Idaho as dean in the College of Science in 2003, Judy served as an associate dean and professor of geosciences at the College of Science at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Judy's research expertise is in paleoclimatology, and she does field studies in Alaska, Argentina, and the Colorado Plateau. Of course, to do everything she's done, she's good at networking. In October 2007, Judy was a panel presenter at the Athena Women's Leadership Conference, and the session was on networking. Judy talked about networking in professional circles for professional benefit. Networking is a way of connecting, a feeling part of a bigger and more meaningful world.
So I put it in a little bit colder way because I'm a scientist. and that is that networking is, when you're talking about networking in a professional sense, it's an exchange of value. Okay, you have to be able to offer something to the other person as much as wanting something mm-hmm. back from that person. And so you need to sort of think about it that way in terms of, you know, how can I help this person out, as well as, you know, what you're thinking, which is how can this person help me out? And so it starts with introducing yourself. And I think this is the thing that's very difficult. The hard thing for a lot of people is just going up to somebody. But these kinds of meetings are great, because these kinds of meetings are where people expect to meet new people, they expect to be approached. And so going up to somebody cold and saying, "Hi, I'm Judy Parrish, you know, I understand that you do X, Y, and Z," or whatever, and you know, it's expected. And so it's easy to have those kinds of conversations. So you need to be sure to put yourself into situations where you can have those opportunities.
So it may be difficult to put ourselves out there, but she does advise us to go forward. And she offers advice about what's called the perfection impulse.
Don't let insecurity get in your way. And another thing is, I found in my career, don't be afraid to show weakness. Nobody's perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, how many women feel like they have to be perfect? I think it's actually a myth that you have to be perfect to succeed. You know, nobody's perfect. And I think that you send out all kinds of messages if you're trying to be a perfectionist and you make a mistake and you make a big deal of it. You send out all kinds of messages that you don't need to send out. Okay, if you make a big deal, you make a mistake, you rectify it, do whatever you need to do, and then just move on. Mm-hmm. I think it's tough for people to think that way, but I think it's really, you know, you don't be so hard on yourself with the networking thing. You know, don't if you're feeling insecure about it. A lot of it's just practice, okay? The more you do it, the easier it becomes. So some of it is just sort of getting yourself out there.
There's another side to that perfection tendency. If we try too hard to be perfect, we might try to do too much.
Kind of a flip side to perfection is overachieving. How many of you have been kind of overachievers and have gotten a little bit of negative feedback on that? You know, it's one of those things about not being nice. Some people consider that if you're an overachiever, that you're not being nice, okay? And that's tough to get across. You know, don't be afraid of being an overachiever, but be gracious about it, okay? I think that, you know, we don't want to sort of lord ourselves over other people. That's just not a nice behavior from anybody.
Now, if we take another flip side to all this, perfection and overachieving, Judy advises us about professional jealousy.
On the other side of overachieving, don't be jealous. I think jealousy is one of those things that we all know how damaging jealousy is in a personal relationship with somebody that we are involved with. it's just as damaging in a professional relationship. If you're jealous of somebody because you think they got a better performance evaluation or they got a higher pay raise or whatever, bury it. Okay? don't think revenge. Don't think, because it's never going to work. It's never going to work. And it's just one of those things that you just have to kind of say, okay, you know, we'll deal with it. That's just the way the world is. The world is inherently unfair sometimes. So I think to some extent we do these numbers on ourselves by, you know, thinking that we know what has been going on and then building up these sort of anxieties around it. And the reason I'm putting this in a discussion of networking is that it all goes back to networking is all about interacting with people. And it's all about providing value. And there are many, many different forms of value that we can provide to people.
Okay, so if networking is an exchange of values, then we need to be sure that we're getting as well as giving value. Judy warns us of those who will take and not give.
Here's another one. How many of you have had people have met people and started to become friendly with people who all of a sudden you realize that they're just going to suck the life out of you? Okay. That can happen professionally too. Okay. So remember that while you want to add value to everybody that you want to network with, you also have a reasonable expectation that somebody, that the other person is going to add value to you. There are professional leeches who will suck up your time. If you are in a very high demand job where time is at a premium, you have to be selfish. And you have to be willing to put those people off. And it's very hard for us to do this. You know, anybody who reads Dear Abby, you know, I'm addicted to Dear Abby because I've been reading it since I was, you know, so I still read it, you know. But, you know, how many times does somebody write in and say, I've got this friend who's just coming around, and, you know, basically the answer is the same, you know, get a spine, you know. It's just very, very hard for us to do that. I don't know if it's harder for men to get rid of leeches than women. I suspect it's not as hard for men, but I don't really know. But that applies professionally too, and it's tough to do it. But you know, you want to be gracious, but you just need to be very firm about it. That if you think somebody is trying to ride on your coattails or get information from you, that they're not going to be in an exchange. You just can't. You just don't have time for that. On the other hand, don't be too quick to judge people either. I think there have been a couple times in my career when I've made snap judgments about people that I really regretted later. Because think of the geeky kid in high school who grew up to be Bill Gates. People like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You need to be kind and generous to everyone. And I think that's just part of being human.
Judy's advice does come from personal experience, so now she takes a few minutes to describe how networking has played a part in her career.
And I'm now speaking from the academic side of things. I agreed to participate professionally, so I'm on grant review panels at NSF, even though I've always lived in the West, and it's a real pain in the you-know-what to fly to Washington, D.C. From here, you know, you lose basically a whole day in travel and then a whole night coming back because of the time zone changes. Serve on committees, give talks at conferences, introduce yourself around. If you have a mentor or somebody who is willing to introduce you, take advantage of that, but don't become a leech for that person either. But choose wisely. Early in your career, very early in your career, I think it's not hurtful to say yes to a lot of things, because you don't necessarily know what's going to turn out to be helpful. As you advance in your career, you'll learn that there are some types of panels and committees and so on, and activities that are going to bring you into contact with people, the people that you need to meet, much more easily than other types of activities. And again, this goes back to preserving your time. So you want to be deliberate about it. There was a point in my career when I was very deliberate about it, and I had I was hired actually at a senior level at the University of Arizona after being at the U.S. Geological Survey. And so I came in to the University of Arizona with a fully developed research program, and I just kept that going just at the University of Arizona. And it came time for my first sabbatical, and I went off on sabbatical, and I did what you do on sabbatical, and I came back, and I realized, you know, I'd been at this institution for 7 years, and I didn't know anything about it, because I'd buried myself in my teaching and my research, and I knew my colleagues, but I didn't know anybody else at the university. And so I went to my department chair, and I said, you know, I'd really like to learn, you know, participate in this institution that has given me so much. And, you know, I was very grateful to be there. What's the most powerful committee on campus, and how do I get on it? And it just so happened that he was the chair of the most powerful committee on campus, and I got on it. I put myself up for election. It was an elected position, and if I hadn't gotten elected the first time, I would have kept trying. And it was a very, very good experience, and in fact, that committee put me on the path that led me to administration. So I learned a tremendous amount, and it opened up a whole new side of my career. You can be that deliberate about it, and think about what you really want to do, and how do you accomplish that, and be willing to take the time to do that.
In addition to being deliberate, Judy had specific advice about mundane parts of the networking task, starting with introducing yourself.
When you're at conferences, for example, and you want to introduce yourself, if you're doing a cold introduction, I've done that many, many times in my career. It's pretty scary. It gets less scary the more you do it. Mm-hmm. Of course, people start knowing who you are. That makes it a little bit easier. Be sure you have something concise to say that shows your value to them. You know, hi, I'm Judy Parrish. You work on X, Y, and Z, and I'm interested in this because I work on A, B, and Z. Okay, something like that. And that'll often kick off a conversation right there. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes you'll get the cold shoulder, okay? And you just can't be afraid of that. Can't be afraid of rejection. And you know, what you can do is sort of harbor this little thought in your heart that 5 years, this person's going to really wish you paid attention to them. I've had that many times, and I've been able to do that. If you've met them before, don't assume they're going to remember you. And that works even as you go along in your career. It's more likely they will remember you the more senior you become, but it's always sort of nice. It's a good way to get them to reintroduce themselves if you know you've met them but you can't remember their name. This works great. Go up and say, hi, I'm Judy Parrish. I don't know if you remember me. And you know, they'll often come back with their name, and that's very helpful. So if nothing else, but it also kind of keeps that personal touch there. And it's. I think this is. I'm going to get to this a little bit more in a minute. But as you progress in your career, it's in a way it's kind of a nice touch for some junior people because they don't expect you to remember them. And if you kind of put yourself on their level, that really makes people feel good about themselves. And that's important. I think as we become older and more senior in our careers, I think it's important for us to try to do that. Don't just say, you know, we met at XYZ conference. Remind them what the conversation was. If you remember, sometimes that's my problem, but, you know, remind them what the conversation was. And then usually if it's connected to their work, you know, they'll remember that.
And now advice about networking as we become more senior in our careers, because that need for networking doesn't go away.
The need for networking doesn't go away as we become more senior in a couple of senses. First of all, I think we have an obligation to help people who are coming up. There were almost all of us had somebody who helped us. I had a couple of very important mentors in my career. And so it's nice to give back. But also because in the sciences anyway, these young professionals, these beginning professionals, they're the ones who are on the cutting edge. Okay, most of us, when we get to our senior level, there are a few senior scientists who stay on the cutting edge of science, but it's not that common for a variety of reasons. We take on more responsibility. grant funding trends change or whatever, you know, all kinds of reasons why senior people, somebody coming out of graduate school with a brand new PhD knows the literature in your field better than you do because they've just had to be examined on it. That's the last time they'll be examined on it. And so it's, you know, it's very helpful. It can be extremely helpful to get to know young, you know, young people coming up because they're going to know things that you don't know. And it also provides you an opportunity to become a mentor, which is nice. So you're not just mentoring. You don't have to just mentor the people in your own institution. You can mentor people elsewhere as well. And I've done that. I mentored a young man at Stanford when I was at Arizona. And we had quite a correspondence because some of his research was related to my research. And his thesis advisor didn't know as much about that part of his research as I did. So it's nice to do that.
Whether early in our careers or later in our careers, it's really good to have extended networks that should include people who don't think like we do.
And I can tell you that some of your best friends, when you're trying to make decisions, are going to be the people who don't think like you do. Okay, and I can trust her when I call her up and just sort of run some ideas by her. I can trust her to tell me I'm wrong. You know, point stuff out, you know, that I haven't thought of, and to have a very different take on things. And it is incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful. So when you find colleagues like that, who you can become friends with and who you can trust, you know, they can be a very, very important part of your network. And you sometimes don't know who they're going to turn out to be. I've found some very surprising people who have really, you know, look at the world in a different way.
And finally, one last piece of advice. Stay open. You just never know who might be helpful.
Don't necessarily assume, you know, assume things about people, because sometimes you just don't know how they're going to end up playing a role in your career.
Dr. Judith Totman Parrish, President of the Geological Society of America, Professor of Geological Sciences at the University of Idaho. This advice on professional networking is from Judy's presentation at the 2007 Athena Women's Leadership Conference at the University of Idaho and brought to you by the UI Women's Center.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
But sometimes making connections is not really what we want. We might prefer to be anonymous.
Since the time I was a child, I trained myself not to appreciate the idea of community. Why? Well, because in my so-called community, I wasn't recognized for what I did or who I was, whatever that may have been in those days. Oh, so you're so-and-so's sister? How is he doing? Aren't you so-and-so's sister? What's he up to nowadays, anyway? Hey, remember so-and-so? This is his sister. Doesn't she look just like him? Occasionally, someone might have asked me, you know, what my name was, but no real inquiry as to who I was beyond the fact that I was my brother's sister was made. Just the association was enough to satisfy the question asker's curiosity. So for me, being known in a community meant the association by relationship to my slightly older brother. This kind of treatment left me feeling anything but a kinship to the people in my life. My identity was stripped down to the bare, naked detail of familial happenstance. And so, I took to eliminating any sense of community or connectedness that was imposed or implied by those around me. Well, really, it wasn't so much my choice as sort of a stumbling into isolation. I figured if no one wanted to know about me or what sort of things made up the person I was, am, or would become, then everyone I happened to meet from that moment on would have to suffer the fate of never knowing anything about me, even if they did happen to ask. This was the pure bliss and appeal of living in a large urban city. No one cares who you are or what you do. The only time you may be paid any attention is if you've affected the life of someone else in some way, inadvertently or otherwise. This phenomena is most likely to occur on the highway. Probably when you've cut someone off on the commute to work and they afford you the courtesy of pressing their middle finger up against the window of their car, which, by the way, is almost always paired with a facial distortion that takes real effort and concentration to conjure. Oh, and the mouthing of some defamatory remark. Yeah, it's the quintessence of recognition in a large city. A true delectable treat. The anonymity that is inevitably included as a part of the package is at least half of its appeal. The city allows you to exist without any knowing or critical eyes watching because there are no eyes behind which that level of familiarity is present. They don't exist. Why on earth would this be appealing? Why would anyone want to live in a life separated from the careful gaze and nurturing of others? Well, this kind of freedom comes with great responsibility. In order to exist successfully in this type of environment, you're required to develop a deep understanding of self-accountability. It's an incredibly introspective experience in which you learn your own versions of right and wrong. You create your own sorts of ethics and morals because there's no one to hold you accountable for your actions but yourself. This is precisely why, as the expression goes, a city can eat you alive when, in reality, you allow yourself to be destroyed or corrupted because that vital understanding is left undeveloped. Over the past few years, I've been faced with the almost impossible task of flying under the radar of the ingrained sense of community that exists in the small town in which I now live. My years of seclusion have helped shape me as an individual with an unshakable sense of self, accompanied by strong ideals, but in a place where community is key, my independence has come into question. The duration of time spent in a small community forces you to eventually succumb to detection. The detection of my presence in the community has yielded questions and invitations meant to help me assimilate into that community. However, it's not necessarily my desire to become a part of the community. Although, to say that these efforts are well-intentioned is a definite understatement. So, I've come up with ways to avert the attention of those interested in getting to know me. Whether it be by avoiding them altogether, changing my routine from time to time, or most challengingly, taking on personas that, yes, are a part of who I am, but scrupulously editing those parts insofar as to reveal only enough with which I'm comfortable to put out there. Even this tactic, though, is a short-lived solution, as I tend to become weary of my perma-smile. No one is that happy. Now, that's not to say I haven't made meaningful and hopefully lasting relationships, but even those I've taken great care and caution in choosing. So, the time is rapidly approaching when the facade will wear. The community will be satisfied to know the person with whom I've allowed them to become acquainted, and I will ultimately leave them with a positive account of my time spent here, and we will part ways. When that time arrives, I will move on to a new place to become free once again, to be completely unknown.
And that piece comes from a young woman who prefers to remain anonymous. Now for installment number 4. The mother-child connection can run strong and deep, or not, among humans, among cats, among dogs, and among chimps. So to wrap up our show about connections, let's go to Jane Goodall and a story about maternal bonding among the deer chimps that she studied. From her presentation at Washington State University in 2007, Jane Goodall.
The thing that's really fascinated me over all these years is the fact that there are good and bad chimpanzee mothers in their society, just as there are in human society. And the good mother is protective, she's affectionate, she's playful, she's tolerant. Above all, she's supportive. And her offspring tend to grow up into individuals who have relaxed relationships with other adults and play a rather important role in the reproductive success of their community. They become high-ranking males. They become prolific females. But those mothers who are more harsh, more punitive, less affectionate, less playful, and above all, less supportive, tend to raise individuals who grow up to be tense and nervous in their interactions with others, and they are less successful as adults in community life. The tremendous importance of early experience is highlighted by research in captive situations, and we find today that human child psychologists and psychiatrists are pointing more and more to the value of those first couple of years in our own children's lives, which brings us to new considerations of, as human child-raising behavior changes in Western civilization, as more mothers go back to work sooner, then what should we be doing to the young ones in those early crucial years, like 1 to 4? So that the child can get the benefit of those years and not be landed in situations which perhaps suit them less well to be really effective adults. That's something which I'm really concerned about and really fascinated in. So in all these different ways, and I could go on and on talking about them, chimpanzees so closely resemble us. And I think it's time for a story here. Let's imagine we're following a young male. He's 25 years old, in his prime, and he's going along through the forest by himself, as young males often do. And suddenly he hears sounds of a group of chimpanzees feeding on something delicious ahead of him in the forest. And 20 of them or so doing that, it's very exciting. So his hair bristles, he moves very fast, he comes to this huge tree filled with feeding chimpanzees and ripe fruit, he rushes up the trunk, he sees a nice bunch of red ripe fruit, aims for it. Well, there's a younger male feeding there, but that's all right, because Satan is dominant to that young male and threatens him. The young male screams and backs away, and Satan begins to feed. What Satan didn't know is that young male's older brother is feeding higher in the tree. And hearing his kid brother scream, he comes swinging down through the branches, and the two brothers together start attacking Satan. So, as I say, Satan was 25, and the young male whom he displaced was about 19, and that young male's older brother was about 5 years older. So the two brothers are now attacking Satan, and Satan begins to scream. To my amazement, a very ancient female with not much hair, shrunken with age, with teeth worn to the gums. She's been feeding very quietly up in the canopy, and now she comes swinging down. She drops her frail little self down on these three battling males, each of whom weighs about twice what she does. And with her little puny fist, she starts hitting at those two brothers. And I think they were so surprised that they mildly threaten her, and Satan gets away. And that was Satan's ancient mother, Sprout. And I tell that story because it illustrates these long-term bonds that develop between chimpanzee mothers and their offspring, and between the brothers and sisters. These bonds can last throughout a life of anything up to 60 years.
That's Jane Goodall talking about family ties. let's wrap up our show with a pertinent song. It's called We Are All Connected. And it's from a CD called We Are All Connected. And the CD sprang from a women's network at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. They created a CD project while they were planning a trip to Darfur, Sudan, with a relief group called Mercy Corps. This was in 2004. Now, they knew the African tradition of bringing a gift whenever you make a visit. So they were preparing a gift for the host. They decided to bring the gift of music. They held a competition to write new and original work for the women of Darfur. So this CD is all original music. It was written for the women of Darfur. And the title song, We Are All Connected, was written by Andrea Whaley. Here it is, sung by Andrea Whaley, Nadia Halliburton, and Nicole Whitehead.
Sisters of the world, I hear your cries on the wind. I can see the light from your eyes and the stars that shine. You are in our thoughts and dreams tonight. We are all connected. We can brave the greatest of storms. We are all connected. We're standing here with open arms. We will always be here for you, although when a smile seems so far away,
just remember you have friends around the world. You are not alone today.
We are all connected. We can brave the greatest of storms. We are all connected.
So glad you could join me for this Yin Radio program on connections. For more about that music, We Are All Connected, you can go to www.berklee.edu/darfur/default.htm. Now, if you'd like to know more about Yin Radio, or if you want to share this program or others with other people in your life, or if you want to catch any parts that you may have missed today, you can go to yinradio.org for podcasts, or to sign up for our electronic newsletter, which tells you what's coming up on Yin Radio. The networking segment on today's show was recorded by Alex Thornburg. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, V as in voice, P as in power. And it comes to you from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I'd like to thank you for joining me. Until next week.